This podcast is supported by The RealReal. Meet Christine. She loves shopping. And this is the sound of fashion overload. Too many fabulous things, not enough space. So Christine started selling with The RealReal.
I've always loved collecting designer pieces. Gucci bags, Prada heels. But my style keeps evolving. Selling with The RealReal? Game changer. I earn more and they do everything.
Seriously, just drop off your items or schedule a pickup. We handle the photos, descriptions, pricing, even shipping. You just sit back and watch your items sell fast to our 38 million members.
And I get peace of mind knowing I earn more selling with The RealReal than anywhere else.
Exactly. This? That's the sound of your closet working for you. The RealReal. Earn more, save time, sell fast. And right now, you can get an extra $100 site credit when you sell for the first time. Go to TheRealReal.com to get your extra $100. TheRealReal.com. That's TheRealReal.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome to the Rise of Justice Movement, the podcast. My name is Zachary Mallory, and I am the host and the founder of the Rise of Justice Movement and the Rise of Justice Movement, the podcast. Today, I'll give a viewer discretion is advised due to the nature of the topics that we will be discussing. Today, I am joined by my new friend that I have connected with on social media, Elisa. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, you wrote a book, and it's incredible, first of all. I am like three chapters in, and I just have to have that moment and that time to sit down and like do a deep dive into it, which I have some time coming up because it is the holidays, taking some time away. And I know we'll jump into some like holiday things and, you know, like very pertinent conversations. But I would love for you to start with a little bit about your background, you know, what led you to writing this book and what that process was like for you. And feel free to introduce yourself as much as you would like. And without further ado, again, it is an honor to sit down and talk to you. And welcome to the podcast.
Oh my gosh. Well, you know how to make a gal real special. Like, thank you so much for those kind words about my book and my work. My name's Elisa Zapersky. I use she, her pronouns, and I am a CSA survivor. And the work that I do really centers around supporting other survivors as we navigate not just like the what happened, but like now what the fuck do we do with our lives? Because there is the like what happened, and then there's like the okay, so like now I want to have meaningful friendships and good sex and like just be a person who is able to exist in the world. And I also have to contend with the fact that trauma still impacts every aspect of me. And also, like, I'm a full ass person. So everything I do has that through line with it. And I started writing and telling sort of my own story on my website, healinghonestly.com, 9 years ago. And it was really just because at the time I was 27 and I just felt like really isolated. And I didn't know. I would learn that I was surrounded by CSA survivors my entire life, but I didn't know at the time, not until I myself went public about my own story. And I just craved connection. And like all these years later, it's a beautiful community across the world of like over 500,000 other survivors. And that has led to also, you know, I do a lot of keynote speaking and workshops and things like that, anything I can do to support survivors and the people who love us. But also to the book, Healing Honestly, which you're referring to, the full title of which is Healing Honestly, The Messy and Magnificent Path to Overcoming Self-Blame and Self-Shame. And we also put on the cover the least re-traumatizing read about CSA for survivors by a survivor. It was published by Barrett Kohler in 2023, and it is a self-help book. It is a book designed for centering CSA survivors, but really for anybody who experienced sexual trauma or just like trauma in their childhood and within their families. And it's really designed to replicate the role of a trusted friend who's been down that road and can offer you love and support, and more than anything, help reduce the feelings of shame that we feel that is not ours to hold, and support each of us in sort of finding our own unique path of what healing can look like. And it includes the voices of 40 other CSA survivors, experts from all around the world who are all also survivors, sharing their wisdom and sharing their words and just being super fucking for real. And I always like to say it's funnier than you think. But that's my baby. That is my literary baby. And yeah, everything I do is about, well, okay, in our day-to-day lives, how can we show up for each other and for ourselves in a world that conditions us to do the exact opposite?
Yeah, absolutely. And you mentioned about healing, and healing is so incredibly complex, and not most people would think about it being linear because it looks different for each person and each personality. And I know, like, I feel that I'm at a place in my own journey, but I don't feel like healing is that destination because I feel like every single day I learn something new or I learn something else. Or I'm like, oh, okay, maybe this does trigger me a little bit, or maybe this, you know. And speaking of triggering, so right now in the world, there's so many things going on. But here in the United States, we have something that is incredibly pressing, and it's a big topic right now. And you know, we'll dive into the holidays here in a second, which yeah, there's a lot of
There's a
things and a lot
lot
of
happening right
emotions that go
now.
into that, but one pertinent thing is the Epstein virus. And I would like to know how you feel from your perspective, you know, being a survivor. Obviously, this brings a lot of emotion because you feel connected to these women and men, you know, just survivors that have come forward. And there's over 1,000 survivors that we know of. And there's like a core group of like 25 or like 27 that, you know, share their stories on like a regular basis. And we sat down and talked to Jess Michaels and also Marina Lacerda, who was known as victim number one in the 2019 Jeffrey Epstein case. And obviously hearing them speak, you know, directly to me is different than watching a news interview or watching them on TV or, you know, anything like or on social media, even. And it's more harrowing than you. So I think sitting down and talking to them, I know several of the other messages, but I would love to know what your reaction is, and you know, how you're feeling in this very let's make a connection because there's a lot of connections to be made, you know, these
Absolutely.
and reclaiming their power and reclaiming those voices is something that I think is incredibly inspiring.
Absolutely. And as you said, you know, healing is dynamic and different for all of us, but it's also different within our own lifetimes. And I think a lot of people are being reminded of that right now because they might have been in a place in their healing where their trauma didn't feel like it was impacting, you know, their everyday lives. And yes, they had triggers and things would come up and then, you know, they would address them, but not that they were in an active state of being re-traumatized all the time. And now that's happening to a lot of us, myself included, absolutely. And, you know, in the book, I really talk about the fact that everybody's healing journey by definition has to be different. And we have to be open to it changing for us too, and what we need changing. For example, I went through like a period in my late 20s where I just like had never felt, I had never been allowed to be angry before. And it's like all the rage that I had ever experienced or repressed my entire life came out all at once and it terrified me. And I felt like the rage was taking over me. And anger gets like a really bad rap, and it's a really powerful and important emotion when it comes to healing because I think anger shows up when we realize that things happened that weren't supposed to happen, that we actually are the victims, and that we have a, I think anger comes when we have an accurate understanding of who actually is the victim and who is the perpetrator. And so I think anger is critical, but it consumed me. And so I learned how to box for 4 years and trained as a boxer. And now I'm like, that doesn't serve me. You know, it's like, and that's okay because healing changes and is dynamic. And I think, you know, in writing a book that supports people for healing, I was like, there's no, I told my, when I was approached about it by my editor, I was like, there's no world where I can prescribe what people need. And like, I'm not going to sell them like some bullshit recipe, you know, some like Instagram ready bullshit recipe, green juice drinking, yoga doing, you know, step by step how to for healing, because it's like nonsense. But what I realized is like, but there are consistencies. And one of the consistencies of those of us who have experienced sexual abuse, but also other forms of trauma and abuse, especially in childhood, is like we are conditioned to take on shame and blame that is not ours to hold, right? Like we are conditioned throughout the abuse, but also in all of the aftermath of it, both explicitly and implicitly, that like everything is our fucking fault. And that doesn't just go away. Like it becomes a conditioning. And all of us have to navigate ways to actually rewrite the script accurately, right? To actually remember, no, there's nothing wrong with me. Something wrong happened to me. And so I really focus on like each of us learning how to identify when we are hearing misplaced self-blame and shame, and how to understand where that's coming from, both in like the bullshit people said in our lives, but also like the bullshit you see on TV and like the bullshit you see in politics and like all of those things that like make up rape culture, and how to identify that, but then also how to flip the script and be like, no, actually the truth is like, I am a fucking amazing person. I am vibrant. I am messy. I am flawed. I am all of these things. And I am worthy of the life that I crave and the life that I desire. And I am worthy and capable of that, you know, and finding our own versions of that. And so to me, I have always found my role, like whether it's speaking, whether it's within the pages of the book, whether it's in my coaching work, which is to help people identify the bullshit voices that are there to no fault of our own and practice different strategies for turning the volume down on them so that each of us can actually hear the wisdom that has like been inside of us all of this time, but has been repressed by the abuse that we've experienced, so that like each of us can find our own, like whatever healing needs to look like for us. And yeah, like we talk about healing being nonlinear. And I think a lot of times people think that means like, okay, well, like I can have a really shit day. And like, yeah, there's that. But also there are whole seasons of our lives that are nonlinear. Like I had made so much progress in my healing. And then I had a kid and I got pregnant and I was sick for 10 months and my body stopped being my own. And I like fully had to disassociate from my body in order to just like get out of bed in the morning. And, you know, I found being pregnant intensely triggering. And I know other people who are survivors who have been pregnant who have like completely different experiences. That was just how it happened to me. And so it was like, you know, like 2 years of trying to heal from that. And that's normal too, you know? And so what I think is unique about this moment, and it also happened at sort of the height of the virality of Me Too, is that we find ourselves in moments of collective re-traumatization for survivors. And it's not just about the things that are happening in our personal lives and that we are individually experiencing. We are collectively experiencing re-traumatization right now. And that is definitely what I've experienced. I think I numbed out for a really long time when it came to the Epstein files. And I mean, for years, I think I numbed myself out as much as I could for as long as I could, because it felt like touching a fire that I had no skills or capacity to prevent from burning the shit out of me. And then I will say in like the last 2 weeks, something has shifted. And it was like, I was listening to a voice inside of myself that actually said, no, you actually have a ton to say about this. And you actually want to use your voice. The anxiety is coming from finding the words and feeling so much all at once and having to parse that out within myself. But, you know, I have found particularly these last 2 weeks enormously triggering. And there are a couple, there's so many reasons why. There are 1,000 reasons why. And there are a million reasons to be triggered, and they're all valid and none of them are your fault, you know? But it's like also like for survivors, it's like so funny because it's like say there's something big in the news, or there's like a big documentary comes out or something, and you're like, you feel like you're supposed to watch it because you think being able to watch it is some reflection of how far along you are in your healing, which it is not. And you feel like you quote unquote should be able to process it. So then you watch it, you get triggered as shit, and then you feel self-blame about that. And you're like, I should have known better. I should have done that. Or you don't watch it, and then you're like, shit, I should have been able to do that. I feel like shame and self-blame for not being able to. And it's like, I find a lot of times in these like collective re-traumatizing moments that there is like this damned if we do, damned if we don't. And so I just want to also like take this moment to be like, it is not your fault if you are triggered by things that are triggering, right? Like complex PTSD is a disability, and we have it caused because of things that happened to us that were not our fault. And now we have to live with it. And part of that is being experiencing triggers, and not triggers in like the bullshit buzzworthy word. I mean, you know it if you have it, what I mean when I say triggers, you know? And so I just want to like offer that reminder of like self-compassion, because all of us are trying to navigate like not just what we see in the news, but like the conversations that are happening around us that we like might not feel like we can stand up and get off the like out of the table. Or you open up social media and you have no intention of consuming the media, but it just like it's literally the first thing you see before you even have a chance to like swipe in a different direction. And so I just think it's like an intensely important time to tap into self-compassion and patience. This is super fucking hard, and there is no right way to navigate this moment. So that's like the most important thing I want to communicate at this moment about it. But beyond that, I have only 1,000 other feelings and thoughts about it.
And every single one of them are completely valid. And I love that you really hit on that part, that it's okay to have a lot of feelings and a lot of emotions right now. It is a lot. And those of us that have been through some form of sexual assault or domestic violence or trafficking even, or sexual abuse, and especially the childhood sexual abuse, because people think that once they turn an adult, it goes away. It doesn't, because those are lingering effects that continue on throughout the rest of your life. You might be in different phases, and the next phase may not look the same as the previous one, and then that next one may not look the same as that one. And like, it continues going. And I think the older that I get, the more wiser I get and understand what my body is telling me. And I'll be 30 next year, and I feel like I'm a lot older, because I feel like it's one of those things, like I feel like I should be a lot older than I actually am, because I had no choice but to grow up at a young age, because I went through some very traumatic shit, and it's like, it's either life or death, and you don't really have that middle ground, and I had to help make some decisions. Like, I didn't really have a childhood, right? I grew up with a narcissistic, abusive, alcoholic stepfather, right? And the only thing I really had was my mom. So, with that, and thinking about, something else that's kind of like lingering in and coming very slowly, and we already have the time change, we already have Halloween, which is personally my favorite time of year. And now we get into my least favorite time of year. A lot of people also feel this way. And it's the holidays. Holiday stress for survivors can specifically be incredibly difficult. And, a lot of the specific statistics on like holiday stress for survivors is very like limited. But we do have some data on like domestic violence and other assaults show increases during the holidays due to certain stressors like increased alcohol consumption, financial strain, and family dynamics. I know I don't get together with my family because it's going to end up being really, 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 really bad. And I get really bad anxiety. I become isolated. It does trigger some trauma because there have been previous arguments, heightened anxiety. And then New Year's Eve specifically shows an increase in assaults compared to other holidays. So holidays, it can bring out the best, but it can also bring out the worst in people. And unfortunately, data does show us that it does oftentimes bring out that absolute worst. So I would love for you to walk us through the holidays and what it can look like for each person, because each person is going to be completely different. But let's talk about that stress during the holidays. You know, you walk in, you see that cousin that you're like, oh, here we go again.
Yeah, totally. The holidays are pretty fucked. Like, it's really fucking hard because even if you're, you've made the really challenging and important decisions that maybe you're not engaging with people in a way that is harmful for you, and like asserting really hard boundaries, you're still living within a society that has all of these very narrow expectations for A, what is a family, and B, like what you're supposed to be doing with that time. So even if you are being like, I'm with my toes in my family, I'm like hanging with my friends, I'm doing my thing, whatever, like you're still watching movies about like a really terrible, probably abusive parent who's like on their deathbed for Christmas and you're supposed to forgive, you know, like there's just so much bullshit pressure beyond the pressure you might like interpersonally be feeling from like a family member to go show up and be somewhere or do something. And so, so it finds you whether or not to some degree, no matter where you are. I think in particular, like the holidays are super fucking hard no matter what. But this year, like the stuff with like, you know, thinking about the Epstein files and the magnitude of the story, I was talking to a friend of mine about it. And he and I were saying it's kind of like a Rorschach test for your family. If you're a survivor, like you go home and see that maybe your family is pretending it didn't happen. And that might be triggering as a reminder of like what happened when maybe you were a kid and things were not talked about, right? And things might have been silenced or pretended to be ignored or repressed. Or maybe they're talking about it and they're not talking about it with any compassion towards survivors. Like so many people are, like so many news articles, so many commentators are speaking in a way that like, it's excruciating. They're ostensibly talking about CSA, but they're not actually talking about CSA because they're not talking about the survivors. And so you might be experiencing a microcosm of that with the people you're interacting with, right? And that feels fucking terrible. But then even, and I've seen this not with this particular case, but in general with survivors, you know, I've supported thousands of survivors in their story, in their healing, and I've seen this multiple times where a parent has, I'm using a parent because that's my experience was being harmed by a parent, and the people I'm thinking of, that's the particular instance, but it can be anybody, right? Like truly anybody who harmed you. They might have a great deal of compassion for these survivors they don't personally know and be offering them way more compassion than they ever offered you. And I think about that even. I'm working my way through Virginia Guffrey's memoir, Nobody's Girl. Knopf, what her publisher was generous enough to send me a copy, and I've been cracked wide open by it. And the pieces that have sort of cracked apart, like I'm still not sure they're going to be put together the same way they were before. Like I am still figuring out how that book is changing me and her words are changing me. But something that really stuck out to me, and this is also just as a caveat, if you are thinking of reading Nobody's Girl, I'm like, of course, support, you know, and show for survivors, but like be extraordinarily mindful with how you consume that book, because it is breathtakingly honest and clear and full of potential triggers for survivors. And I'm not saying don't read it. I'm not saying read it. I'm just saying be, center your well-being as you consider it. You know, something that really struck me about Virginia's story is that she was sexually abused by her father. And her father, when Virginia came out against Jeffrey Epstein, her father was somebody tracked her down, like tracked her dad down, and interviewed him and he was like, I am so proud of my daughter, Virginia. Way to take like these like terrible men to task and hold them accountable. And that's so amazing. But, you know, even to this day, after Virginia's death, her father still denies that he ever abused Virginia. And so I say that as like a really, really on the nose example. But I think also, you know, so it's like we have this story that nobody doesn't know about. Even in our siloed media consumption these days, everyone knows about this story of Epstein. And there's only a plethora of ways people can respond that would be really fucking triggering. And so no matter whether you're choosing to be present in places that don't feel quite right or choosing to do something different or choosing some, you know, mix that is just like full of boundaries that work for you, like what you need to remember is that nobody's comfort is more important than your safety. No one's comfort is more important than your safety. So what that means is sometimes we hurt people's feelings. Sometimes we don't go along to get along, maybe. Sometimes other people have expectations of things they want from us, but because it interferes with our literal safety needs, that has to come first. And I know, whomever you are listening to this, you yourself are the expert in your safety. Only you know what is in the best interest of your safety. And that's the responsibility you have to yourself. And it's not fucking easy. And the people who you most need boundaries from are the people most likely to attack you for those boundaries. But I just want to remind you, no matter what you choose to do, that no one's comfort is more important than your safety and the safety of also any child who might be around you as well, right? There is no go hug Uncle Lester, right? Who gives a shit if Uncle Lester's feelings are hurt? His comfort is not more important, right? And it's really easy to say, and it's really fucking hard to practice. And the other thing I want to say is that, you know, in my chapter about, the book is organized by like aspects of our lives. So there's like a chapter on traumatic memory and why it's normal not to remember abuse. And there's a chapter on our health and our like physical health and it being connected to our trauma. And there's a chapter on friendship and sex and romantic relationships and family. And in the family chapter, we really focus on rewriting this script that by simply living in our truth or protecting our safety needs, we are somehow ruining a family. That is like the lie that is such a through line for so many, like thousands of survivors I have been in community with and supported and spoken directly with, including myself. Like I was always the black sheep. I always was positioned and told I was ruining the family. And by simply trying to keep myself safe as a child and then as an adult living with trauma. And there is no such thing as that. And I've had really incredible friends and survivor leaders who I've turned to who have taught me a whole fucking lot about this. But it was really my friend who is also a survivor and who became my book editor, which was my book editor first and then friend, Charlotte Ashlock, who said to me, she said, you know, Elisa, like when we protect ourselves, we protect our family. When we heal ourselves, we heal our family because no one gets to decide we're not a part of that family. And so when we heal ourselves, we heal our family, whether they want it or not. And it's not like, you know, that estranged person from you is going to turn to you and be like, wow, you've really healed us. But when you think about yourself as a part of the lineage of ancestors who came before you and descendants who follow after you, when you heal yourself, you offer healing to that entire lineage, that entire lineage. I can feel when I was writing my book, I felt ancestors with me whose names I never knew healing alongside me. And I'm offering directly, you know, like I have a kid, I'm directly offering healing for that next generation, but I'm also offering healing for any child in my life in any capacity, whether related to me or not. You know, my kids' friends who call me auntie, like I am offering that for them too, because of like how I can am able to show up for them. And so I think that's really important. No one gets to decide. Nobody is the arbiter and the decision maker about who is in a family or not. And you can be as estranged as you want. And still, when you are healing, you are offering healing to that family. And that dividends might not be shown until generations to come. And they might never acknowledge that it happened. But you are doing that work. You are offering a gift to your lineage. And you're being an incredible ancestor while you're doing that too. And I really have to name so many Black feminist CSA survivors who really helped teach me that, including Aisha Shahida Simmons and Tejmika Turuk and Alicia Sanchez Gill, all of whom are also in Healing Honestly in the book. But I think that's the most important thing I can offer you, is that the details of how you navigate this time and the decisions you make, I trust 100% that you know what's best for you. And even if that looks like something other people can't understand, maybe that actually involves sharing space with somebody harmful, but because of the very specific details of your circumstance, like that actually is what is safer. I trust you. I trust that you know what's best for you. And when those bullshit voices come back to you the way they come for all of us, because that is how we've been conditioned and what the world has taught survivors, that somehow we're the ones to blame for things being fucked up in our family, even though we're the victims of it. I want you to remember, when you protect yourself and you offer safety and you offer healing to yourself, you offer that to your family at the same time. And that is a gift that you are offering that supersedes all of our lives.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I think you hit it right on the nail whenever you say that it's not your fault. And, you know, whenever you come out against your uncle for sexually abusing you as a child, you know, you're looked at as like this black sheep of the family, right? You're looked at as you're not this and you're not that. Walk on the table anymore. You can't come here, you can't come there, because you're seen as like you shattered the family. And I have heard a lot of horror stories. You know, I have friends that have actually recently messaged me like, okay, we're getting close to the holidays, you know, can I add you to my contact list in case things go south? And I'm like, oh shit, yeah. And that's the reality that a lot of people face. They're like, you know, I need to know my three people that I can call, like in the event of this or event of that. And unfortunately, fortunately or unfortunately, however you see it, because it is an unfortunate circumstance, but I'm fortunate that they chose me because they trust me, they believe, you know, in the way I do, to help them get access to the resources that they potentially could need. So I see it as, it's like a double-edged sword there. But we got a lot of work to do in this space. We have a lot of work to do in spaces around us, because intersectionality is key. And if we address one thing, we have to address the entire picture and the entire thing here about this entire issue and the generational trauma that also exists as the underlying aspect of these issues that we have. So thinking about, you know, like utilizing like social media, and I talk about social media a lot on this podcast, but how have you used social media as a way to kind of like amplify the work that you are doing, but also how do you connect with other people with the social media space? Because historically, you know, meta platforms have been incredibly censored whenever you talk about rape, you talk about domestic violence or survival, or sexual assault, whatever. But what's your social media experience?
It's So interesting you ask about social media because my relationship to it has really changed very recently. So my website, healinghonestly.com, is where I put all of my stories, and I have a weekly newsletter that I still put out every week. It's been like 7 years. And that has been like a key way of like cultivating community online, especially global community online. And, you know, it was a space, it is still a space that I own. But I've pivoted to writing much more on Substack because it's like much easier to have membership and it's easier for people to find it. And accessibility is my goal right now because people's needs have never been greater and the resources are disappearing before our very eyes. And I do have fear that like Substack is not owned by progressive people in the slightest. And one of the owners is actually like deeply fucked. And so, you know, there is that feeling of like not being able to, like one of my goals from the winter break, I always am like, I thrive in Q4. Like when everybody else is checked out, I'm like getting shit done. And I'm like, I have to make sure all my stories are, my Substack is also on my website because like I cannot count on that being there. Right. And so I used social media very limitedly because it made me quite unhappy. And I, the first year my child was alive, I didn't use it once. Like it worked really well for me for the time. And then, Trump was elected. And the next day I woke up with a clarity of what I needed to be doing. Like, I was lost. I was a year postpartum. I was just like, not even at that point. And I had my book, but I was like, it can be a very disorienting time in a birthing person's life. You know, that first year and you're just like, who am I? And then Trump got elected and I was like, oh, right, this is who I am. It became immediately clear to me that survivor services were going to disappear. And also that these institutions that have been incredible supporters of my work, like national conferences and, you know, organizations of doctors and advocates and college campuses and, you know, all these places where I have been invited to be and then been able to connect with survivors like through them, that all of those could go away and fast. And a lot of them have a lot faster than I even thought that day. And I realized, okay, well, I have a capacity to be able to connect with survivors in a way that like certain people really fuck with. Like, you know, my inbox for years has always been like, you know, I've never told anybody this, not even my therapist, but, you know, I always joke like that's my tombstone. But, you know, there is a way that I talk about trauma and the way that I talk about healing that for a certain group of people or subsect of the world, like they fuck with it and it feels accessible and approachable and like not so damn scary to like engage with. And I'm very proud of that. And so I was like, okay, I have to find a way to meet people wherever they are, because the ways I have been doing it, we cannot count on anymore. And so I hired a social media coach, an extraordinary, extraordinary activist, writer, human being, named Flint Del Sol. And he also has an enormous platform. He is a trans man who documented a lot of his transition throughout the recent years. And he also, on a limited basis, does social media coaching. And life brought us together. He had found my book and it met him and his family at a time that really connected with people he loved. And that was really fucking cool. So it was just like, as you know, we say in Yiddish, we say beshert, like it was just in the stars. We met like the next day practically. And I was like, oh, I need somebody to teach me how to do this so I don't lose my mind, so that I don't spiral in all of the ways social media can make you spiral. And I can stay focused on what I'm trying to do, which is meet survivors wherever they are and offer them the support that they need, especially at a time when the Trump administration has cut over $500 million of funding for survivor services. And that impacts every aspect of survivors getting support. Every single aspect and every single part of every kind of survivor needing any kind of support. And so I started working with him, learning how to communicate in social media and make videos and get comfortable making videos and finding ways. As you can tell, I love to fucking chat. This girl loves to run her fucking mouth. And how to do that, but in 60-second fragments. And, you know, I went viral for the first time on Mother's Day, and I'll never forget, because it was like, you know, it was my second Mother's Day. So it was very poignant. And this video I made had like over 1 million views. And it was about Sigmund Freud being really fucked up about CSA survivors and memory. And it was my first time going like truly viral, and it was terrifying. And it was like kind of anti-Semitic really quick. And it just got like fucked up. And I was really terrified. And I was like, oh, no, I hate this. But I've worked through that experience to keep like figuring out what it means to do this and try to do it sustainably with always the same mission in mind, you know, and then my platform really has grown as a result. And I am hearing exactly what I set out to, which is like people DMing me being like, one, I didn't know your book existed, and like, oh my God, this is the resource I need, or this is the resource my bestie needs, and I'm going to buy it for her, and like, whatever. And, but also getting messages being like, I like literally saying, I like the way you say things. Like, I like the way you say things. Like, it makes sense to me. Like, it helps. And I'm like, fuck yeah, that's like all I wanted. And so I'm trying really to center the parts of social media that offer connection and humanity and help meet people in their isolation and help them feel a sense of community without ever, especially like the beautiful part of the internet. And that's like what's been so significant in my experience is that like a lot of people want support and don't feel safe or comfortable like showing up in a physical space or in a space that can't be anonymous. And in its best form, the internet allows for people to find community and support while still honoring like whatever those safety needs are for them. And I am like seeing that happen through my social media work, through the like trolls, through the like terrifying, at times very poignant targeted comments, through like all of that bullshit. But how do I like not spiral out in terror? I have a coach, like, and he'll tell me, like, get off the fucking internet for, like, 3 days. Like, he'll be like, don't post anything for, like, the next 5 days. Relax. Like, go touch grass. And that really helps, too, you know? But as for, like, meta and trying to navigate censored words and censored ideas, you know, it's a moving fucking target. And I spoke on a panel at this Trust and Safety conference in San Francisco in July. That's all these content moderators and executives who do safety and content moderation for like all the social media platforms. And I learned a couple of things. One, it's all like they're all utilizing AI companies to do this work for them. And theoretically then, like AI does a lot of the content moderation, and then once things are flagged, theoretically, then like a human is reviewing it at that point. And on one hand, like in a very important way, I actually do think that like this is maybe the one use of AI I like can fuck with especially as like a writer. Because all of these content moderators were getting the shit triggered out of them, and they were all traumatized, and they were all developing PTSD. And they had no resources to understand what was happening to them or to be supported. And now I in these conversations I was having with folks at this conference, like a lot of that is a lot better because of AI. AI can do a lot, especially of the image work. And then it helps for like sort of up the pipeline when humans are then looking at it to be able to do so in a way that isn't just going to be so like Clockwork Orange all of the time. But, you know, I spoke on this panel and I said to them, I was like, it's actually like really fucking hard for me to do my job when I'm not supposed to say the word like child sexual abuse survivor and I have to say CSA, and then I get so many comments of people being like, what is CSA? You know, like, that's not helpful. It's not helpful that I have to use an image of a bunch of grapes to talk about rape, you know? And so I do think like there is that whole part of it as well. And then there's the part that's like, who knows when this stuff also starts getting repressed or like suppressed when I'm like running my mouth about, you know, different political leaders and things of such. So yeah, it's a moving target, man. It really is.
You know, and a lot of people, well, they'll DM us and they'll message us like, so you have over 200,000 followers, but you talk about censorship. Like, yeah, we have 245,000 followers now, but we're still shadow banned like crazy. We're still censored like absolute crazy. Like you said, I can post a picture of my mom's dog and it, you know, gets like a lot of traction, right? But God forbid you post about a survivor, or you post about police violence, or you post about housing, or you post about something, it gets shadow banned like absolutely fucking crazy. And it's wild. And, you know, there's things that we'll also share that other big accounts have also shared, and we get dinged for it. I've noticed that quite a bit. And then it's reported, you know, we appeal it. And then, you know, 9 times out of 10, we win that appeal. They allow it back, blah, blah, blah. They're like, well, you know, just don't do it again. And then there's like the remix function on Instagram that if you do it too many times, it blocks your account from being shown to people who don't follow you. And you're not recommendable. Like, your content is not recommendable to people outside of your own followers. So then you have